I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm speaking today with Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and co-edits inequality.org, which puts out a weekly newsletter I highly recommend. And a couple of Chuck's recent books include The Wealth Hoarders and his first novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, and you can learn more at inequality.org and chuckcollinswrites.com. That's all one word, Chuck Collins Writes. And it's rights like literature, not rights like civil rights. Okay, on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally. Terrence McNally, McNally, TerrenceMcNally.net. In this crucial election year in which democracy itself may be on the ballot, let me also encourage you, as I do every week now, not only to get involved with the candidate campaigns that strike a chord with you, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans are able to exercise their right to vote. Turning to today's guest, the Occupy movement emerged in 2012, and though it didn't demand or produce specific policies, it introduced into the national conversation the concept of the 99%, and at the same time, of course, the 1%, highlighting for all the vast and growing inequality of income, wealth, and power in the U.S. Yet here we are 12 years later, and for the most part, things are still only getting worse. In mid-March, the Institute for Policy Studies and Americans for Tax Fairness released a report that analyzed executive pay data for some of the country's most notorious corporate tax dodgers over the period 2018 to 2022. It found that 64 of them paid more to their top five executives than they did in federal taxes in at least two out of those 5 years. And for over half of those corporations, their payouts to top corporate brass over that entire span exceeded their net tax payments. Just the latest attention-getting perspective on the problem, joining, the many reports it seems to me I see every month or so of the relative wealth of several oligarchs versus the entire lower half or lower two-thirds of the population. And with the relentless reports of that sort of inequality, I don't know if my question is, why don't the rich or the super rich and their corporations understand the value of a society that works? Or is it, why don't they care? What do I mean by a society that works? One that recognizes its challenges and does its best to meet them. It's that simple. I would think that that would be worth more than the next billion, or perhaps even the next million if you go down the, you know, down the ladder just a little bit, or the next few homes, or the next super yacht. I would think that most of the wealthy and their corporate boards know, for instance, that stock buybacks are in most cases at the cost of something else, something valuable like innovation or safety. Hello, Boeing, or fairness. A society that works can still generate significant financial rewards, and the savings would be enormous in areas like public safety, healthcare, productivity, the way people feel about their work, about their company, about their government. I'm reminded of something I read in Hamish McRae's 1994 book, The World in 2020. It's funny how we put these dates out in the future, 2001, 1984, the world in 2020, and then we live our ways right past them. I'm not going to quote him, but the idea that stuck with me is that the U.S. as a society, he's a Brit and he was looking globally. The U.S. as a society does some things very well in terms of creativity and execution, but that we drag ourselves down and waste a lot of resources. And by resources, I mean money and people's lives. In unnecessary friction in the system, litigiousness, crime, holes in healthcare and the safety net. And that was in 1994. That's mid-Clinton. That's pre-2008 crash. That's pre-pandemic. That's pre-Trump. And that's pre the explosion of private equity. There's also the long-term global epidemiological study of inequality by Wilkinson and Pickett in their book, The Spirit Level. Looking at 30 years of data, they found that everyone, rich or poor, does worse in all sorts of dimensions with high levels of inequality in a society. And among the wealthiest countries, the last I looked, the U.S. was the most unequal. What am I missing? Why isn't mine a valid way to approach the way we operate? The personal notion that once I can expect that I'm likely going to be secure or perhaps even comfortable, that I turn some of my attention to helping make a society that works. Is it driven by the belief that my running my life or my company that way wouldn't work unless others, perhaps most or all, did the same? Despite the knowledge that it might be impossible, the monumental challenge we face to move society in that direction calls for doing things and getting ideas and models out into the world that show what's possible to actually reduce inequality. And that's what today's guest, Chuck Collins, has been doing for years in his work and in his writing. Chuck Collins directs the program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, co-edits inequality.org, which, as I said, puts out a weekly newsletter that I highly recommend. He's co-founder of divestinvest.org, a global movement to divest from fossil fuels and invest in climate solutions. He's a trustee of the Post-Carbon Institute and resilience.org, and a founding board member of Patriotic Millionaires. His books include Robin Hood Was Right, A Guide to Giving Your Money for Social Change, 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, Born on Third Base, sort of a personal memoir of his own life and perspective, Born on Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. Wealth and Our Commonwealth, Why America Should Tax Accumulated Fortunes, which incidentally was co-authored with Bill Gates Sr. The Wealth Hoarders, as I mentioned, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions, and in 2023, his first novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun. Welcome again, Chuck Collins, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Hi, Terrence. Thank you for having me back.
You are very welcome. Let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, April 18th. As you know, Chuck, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work we talk about. And you've been a guest on this show several times. But for those who may not know your story, you grew up wealthy and have dedicated much of your life to the fight against gross inequality. Could you briefly share about your evolution? And here's just a question, for instance, that occurred to me. Did you notice or talk about inequality growing up? And if not, when did the realization about the scale and impact of it hit you?
Well, as the title of the book says, I was born on third base. My great-grandfather was the meat packer Oscar Mayer, so I grew up in a, you could call it kind of a dynastically wealthy family. I'm like the fourth generation. One of the things, though, my mom grew up with a little more of a working class background, and we lived in the suburbs of Detroit. So I was 7 years old in 1967 when the so-called Detroit riots, the uprising in Detroit, happened. And you know, most 7-year-olds are just going about their business, but my day was disrupted. For one thing, the Detroit Tigers baseball team did not play for several days, and I was, you know, watching the TV and reading, looking at the Detroit news and seeing these photographs and kind of scratching my head and asking my parents lots of questions. What's going on? You know, why isn't Dad going to work? And why is it that people are upset? And are black people mad at white people? And you know, and I understood that this was rooted in that huge gulf between city, suburb, rich and poor, white and black. So that like planted a little seed in my consciousness that you know, maybe not all is well. And then later I kind of began to understand, huh, we're not just sort of in the middle class like everybody tells us we are. I'm kind of in a unique position here. And then, you know, later in high school and then later, just starting to understand the picture. And even in my early 20s, traveling to Central America and getting even more of a global picture of just how advantaged my upbringing was. So all of that kind of contributed to a pretty deep concern about inequality generally.
Okay, and we're going to get into some of the specific, as I said in the intro, you are working at projects and models and organizations and so on to in this battle, and we'll get into specifics. But because I was afraid I might get to the big underlying questions, if I started with them, I'm going to start with some of the big underlying questions, which is, as I said in my intro, it seems to me, you know, if I look just politically right now, it's certainly much better. And in fact, the only sane thing is to vote for Democrats, certainly on the federal level and in most cases on the state level or the local level. But while that's necessary, that's not sufficient. These problems, as I point out, Occupy puts 99% out in the world, people rally around it. 12 years later, we have reports like the one I cited and the many that we see. Given the depth of current inequalities, as you wake up in the morning and set about, you know, your many tasks in this arena, do you feel it's possible to reverse the tide? And as I think even something you wrote says, is it possible without an economic depression or a world war?
Well, I do think we are. It's a situation where the longer, the deeper the inequalities go, the harder it is to get, is to shift it. It's like your car is stuck in the dirt and you just keep spinning the tires, going down, down. It's going to be harder to climb out of those ruts, deal with the concentration of wealth. But I do continue to have a hope, a possibility that we're going to find a way to nonviolently reverse some of these trends. And part of what gives me that insight is I actually keep meeting wealthy people. This kind of goes to your intro. I keep meeting very wealthy people who sort of see that this is completely unsustainable, and are kind of changing their views on this, and then actually engaging and trying to promote a society that has less inequality. You know, so you mentioned the Patriotic Millionaires Network. This is a group of very high net worth folks who basically are saying, increase my taxes, raise the wage floor, diminish the power of wealth. And I see these other cracks in the system. Maybe it's a stage of kind of very late capitalism where the beneficiaries start to wonder whether the system is working anymore. That's how extreme the levels of inequality have become. That even the beneficiaries are saying, wow, this is not going to end well.
Yeah, exactly. I want to make the point that both Rebecca Henderson, who's at the Harvard B School, and Branko Milanovic, renowned economist on the issues of inequality, that they both, when I interviewed them, got to a key point, which was that capitalism works and has worked. You know, people always cite how it has delivered billions out of poverty, but that it crosses a line when the wealthy and their corporations begin to make their own rules, which is what has happened with lobbying, especially post-Citizens United, that's when it breaks down, that capitalism is corrupted at that point, and we're way past that. And I'm going to cite one other thing and then throw it to you again. And that is the study by Princeton's Martin Gillens and Northwestern's Benjamin Page, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And they found that how inequality, wealth, and poverty affect politics. And what they found was that, I'm quoting now, a proposed policy change with low support among economically elite Americans is adopted only about 18% of the time, while a proposed change with high support from those high wealth people is adopted 45% of the time. They concluded that policymaking in the current system is so dominated by wealth that the opinions, which to some extent have finally moved in the right direction on a lot of issues, of the middle class and the working class don't really matter. So there I just throw in two more points of the making its own rules and overriding power of wealth in government. Some response to those factors in this whole game.
Yeah, you know, what I've seen in your and my lifetime is now we're in what I would call like the fifth decade of inequality. It started off with wage inequality. You know, incomes of workers were flat or stagnant, most of the income gains flowing upward to the 1%. In the last 15 years, we're seeing a extreme concentration of wealth, where, you know, it's not just income and wealth gains going to the 1%, it's going to the top 1/10 mm-hmm. of 1%. And that corruption that you described, the sort of rulemaking process, hits that moment when the I call it the oligarchic threshold, mm-hmm. where it's not just wealth, it's power. And people are using their power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. And that's that. And then you also hit this hyper extractive moment. You know, it's one thing where, okay, our cities have lived through gentrification, wealthy people bidding up the cost of land and housing. But now segments of wealth are preying on this unfortunate situation, are extracting even more wealth from the housing market. You know, oh, people can't afford to buy a house, so our private equity firm is going to buy up all the single family houses and rent them back to working people because they can't afford to buy their own home in this economy. So we're going to extract even more wealth from this unequal dynamic. So in each of those cases, yeah, I think we're you know, and then the other just piece of the dynamic I see is the enabling sector, the wealth defense industry, mm-hmm. the tax attorneys and the lobbyists and the wealth advisors, they kind of have a class interest in the expansion of this system too. So they're involved in shifting the rules, or we're going to make it easier for private jet owners to, you know, pay lower fees and, you know, travel without anonymously. We're just going to keep changing the rules to benefit the ultra wealthy. And so there's a sort of enabler class that's mm-hmm. also in there pressing for these inequalities. So you even have the situation where some wealthy people are like, hey, I don't really want to avoid taxes anymore. I actually think I should pay my fair share of taxes. And they're surrounded by advisors who are going, no, you can't do that. That's the system is going to, you know.
Yeah.
So it becomes a deeply systemic driving toward more and more concentrated wealth, which, as we're saying, is not sustainable.
Right. And the thing I think that we both haven't quite said out loud, but is behind what we're saying, like when you said, you know, people who go this isn't going to end well, is that, and that's why I broached it in so broadly as a society that works. is that what you do with this, in addition to everything we've said on a policy basis and a rulemaking basis and an actual exchange of money basis, is you build cynicism, resignation, grievance, and the political polarization that is exploited by Trump and others is a result of this that then attacks things like trust and community and those sorts of things, which I think is a dangerous on an existential level to us as a society.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of find myself making the case to my peers. Look, these inequalities are bad for everyone, including the ultra wealthy, because we're essentially seeding the instabilities of and social breakdown. You know, that if you care about the functioning of markets, well, these concentrations of wealth and this rule rigging process are going to lead to monopolies and distortions and undermining healthy, you know, mercantile capitalism, if that's important. It's clearly fueling polarization and democratic breakdown. You know, it's bad for the economy, bad for democracy, it's bad for civic life. And you mentioned the spirit level, Richard Wilkinson, Kate Pickett's book, saying, you know, it's bad for social cohesion, health, gone down the list. Lately, I've kind of described the problem as the billionaire disruption. The concentration of wealth is pretty much undermining everything we care about. You name the category, I'll tell you how it's undermining it. You know, housing, affordable housing, sports, culture. Go yeah. down the list. It's yeah, and, wrecking the world.
And the other side of that, and this was occurring to me, I hadn't written it down yet, but this was occurring to me last night, is that the sort of terrible, antisocial, anti-human prejudices that are inflamed in an effort to put in the candidates who will then produce the tax breaks, right? In other words, the byproduct, because it's the way that the very wealthy get what they want politically, is a bunch of social inequities and social prejudices and social breakdown that they themselves would never want in their own lives and wouldn't want in their society, including, I mean, even I would say, the you know, the reversal of Roe v. Wade, you know, I mean, all sorts of things that fall, and the anti-LGBTQ things and all the culture war stuff that are cultivated and inflamed to get the financial benefits they want.
Yeah, I think that whatever divisions or cleavages there are in the culture and society, they sort of get supercharged by these inequalities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people understandably are like, well, who am I mad? Who should I be mad at?
Right.
You know, and there's plenty of people to offer you a deflection there.
Yep.
You know, don't look over here behind the curtain. Don't look at billionaire manipulation of the rules of the economy. Look at those new immigrants who are,
yep.
you know, or the people who are different, or, you
yep.
know, and we do have those seeds of prejudice, and they get inflamed in a polarized society, and they kind of de-escalate in more healthy, equal society.
That's, you know? That's one of the things I was trying to say in that introduction, is that if we actually, if the wealthy and the powerful actually produce a society that works, the gains for everyone in terms of cohesion and a willingness to take on the big challenges we face, like climate and public health and war and peace and all of those things, would be so, you know, it would be so different if we had the can-do sort of society that we have had at times in the past. And as we switch into the things that you are working on now, you point out that we were in this situation, I guess it's the early 20th century, and we that earlier Gilded Age, and we came around. We made some changes. We didn't make them in time to forestall the Depression, so then we made more changes in the Depression. We have changed in the past.
I think that's a really important part of the story is we, the United States, coming out of World War II, had a more or less shared prosperity economic engine. It wasn't entirely racially inclusive,
Right.
but the idea was you tax extreme wealth and you invest it in things that create opportunities for everybody, home ownership, access to education, infrastructure that benefits everybody. Other societies, we can look to the European kind of social democracies. They're much more equal societies. The wealthy are not as extremely wealthy. The poor, there's a floor of decency through which you can't fall. So there's a higher social floor and a lower concentration of wealth, and those are happier, healthier, more dynamic societies. They have higher rates of entrepreneurship, all kinds of indicators that show, when a society that works for everybody.
Right. And two, one thing you point out there, when you said innovation and entrepreneurship, people, I think, still say, oh, yeah, but their high taxes and their strong safety nets have a cost. We're more entrepreneurial and we have more social mobility. Those used to be true, they no longer are.
That's right. If you want the American dream now, you need to move to Canada, at least if you're not born wealthy.
Right.
If you're not born wealthy, you are better off in a society where you can have access to high quality education, debt-free college. If you have a setback, the society will help you get back on your feet so you can become a taxpayer and contributor. That's what those European, when I mentioned higher rates of entrepreneurship. We like to, in the United States, like banter that around, like, hey, everybody can be an entrepreneur. Well, actually, to take a sort of leap and a risk and start your own enterprise requires a certain amount of social capital and sometimes a safety net, so that if you leap and fall, you don't go have to live in your car, and that's very different in European social democracies, where you can take a chance and things don't go well, then you go back to school for 18 months and you get a stipend so you can retool. Like, it's a very different, and that's what a society that works does, is it lifts up everybody. It doesn't treat anybody as cannon fodder or a waste in terms of their own skills and contribution. Everybody has a part to play.
No, it's so interesting that gets lost. That safety net, I mean, somehow some of the rich decided to tell the story that it was only helping people of color and immigrants, and then people believed that, and so they're against the thing which actually gives, as you point out, the cushion. Which I what I think that the way that what maybe even one reason why immigrants seem to be so entrepreneurial is that they still have extended family as a way of creating their own safety nets and so on. They have perhaps a greater sense of community that creates this safety net that the government isn't providing and so on.
I think that's a really key insight, because people will say, "Well, look, this first generation immigrant over here, they look, they've got to the middle class, but we don't sort of see all that social capital, those sacrificial support systems, sometimes sort of a patriarchal support system that sort of helps lift up one person so they lift everyone else up. There's different ways people have, how do you say, adapted to the situation. But, think about in the 1970s, early 1970s, we were sort of on course to be one of the to be Sweden or Finland or something, and then we took this horrific wrong turn, and it did have to do with this narrative you described, this narrative of I did it alone, individualism, you know, we're not a community, we're isolated individuals. There are winners and losers. There's a whole other narrative that came to supplant the, hey, we're in this together and we can build an economy that lifts up everybody kind of story.
Yeah, and one thing, by the way, I spoke with Astra Taylor. I assume you know her work, books, a lot of books, and then the debt,
Solidarity, yeah.
and that's exactly solidarity. And one thing she pointed out that had slipped my mind, if you will, was that the pandemic showed the money's there. In other words, we did the impossible during the pandemic. We gave child tax credits. We stopped evictions. We did those things that people say we can't do. We did them. And the results were amazing. And then we reverted to business as usual.
Yeah, it's fascinating in times of crisis, economic and, you know, in a pandemic crisis situation, this tremendous capacity we have as a society when we act together. You know, and I think a lot of people got a window into A, just how harmful extreme inequality is. In the pandemic, it was clearly a life and death matter.
That's right.
Who was on the front lines, who took the greatest risks? Who got to stay home and or just collect their investment income, whatever? Who got to fly a private jet to go on vacation?
Yeah.
All, you know, it was like, and the fact that the wealth of the billionaire class doubled
Oh.
in 4 years, you know, went from you know, the U.S. billionaires went from $2.5 trillion combined wealth to now over $5 trillion. So people kind of got a window into like, huh. You know, maybe the rules are tipped in favor of the wealthy. Maybe this is not a good thing. But we also saw, yeah, we can tax and then make investments that really can make a difference in our lives. And I think we you know, we actually came I we came within 2 votes in the US Senate of passing this Build Back Better legislation that would have been a $4 trillion investment in transition to a green economy, creating a real system of childcare in this country, and it was all going to be paid for on by taxes on multimillionaires and billionaires. We
Yeah.
came so close.
And when you say 2 votes, do you mean Manchin and Sinema?
Those were the 2 votes. Yeah.
And neither of them will be in the Senate when it convenes after the next election. Let's just hope they're replaced by people who would go in that direction. Let me tell people, this is Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chuck Collins. He directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He co-edits inequality.org, and his recent books include The Wealth Hoarders and his first novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun. You can learn more at inequality.org and at Chuck Collins Writes. That's all one word, Chuck Collins Writes with a W.com. Let's switch to what you're working on now. And you mentioned it before, what you call billionaire disruption. Now, it seems to me it's a double meaning there. One is the disruption caused by billionaires, and then the other might be the attempts to disrupt the billionaires. What do you mean when you say that phrase, and how are you working on it?
Well, I think what I mean by that is that how the concentration of wealth is disrupting the various spheres of our life. So yeah, to look at that, you know, we have been tracking sort of this issue of billionaire concentrated wealth, just the huge share of wealth flowing upwards. My colleague Bob Lord recently wrote an article saying we're pretty much in the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to see our first trillionaire.
Ooh.
If all just stays on track, meaning if the wealth of the billionaire class keeps doubling every couple of 5 or 6 years,
Yeah.
that's where we're going to end up. So part of it is to just understand what are the harms caused by that. And you know, we have a project that looks at how concentrated wealth affects the climate, you know, the sort of intersection of extreme wealth and climate disruption. You know, we know, for instance, the richest 1% contribute 50% of aviation emissions, 1% of the flying public, primarily flying in this case on private jets, are contributing 50% of aviation emissions.
Wow.
So that's just like one tiny little sliver. So yeah, I'm very much involved in a project that's looking at private jets and how we as the rest of society subsidizes their travel, not only in terms of climate disruption, but they actually don't even pay their fair share in terms of the aviation space. You know, 16% of all planes are private aviation, and they only chip in 2% of the cost of the airspace. You know,
so this goes back to that thing you were talking about before, Chuck, about how there's a whole industry that is tinkering with the rules. And when I first started seeing information from you folks, and I happened to subscribe to the Boston Globe, my son is, you know, in Cambridge these days. And so I went, okay, I'll do. And this is the two stories that I've really been following are the Hanscom Field, which I'll let you talk about because it's taking kind of a big concept and bringing it down to the very local level. And the other is the Seward Hospital chain, which is another, you know, so first talk about Hanscom Field and then talk about the Seward Hospital chain and what that shows us.
Yeah. Well, and there's a funny connection between them. But yeah, the larger problem here is there is a tremendous demand for private jets. You know, you got 800 billionaires, they all have a couple. You have, you know, a surge in the demand for private jets. And then, so this has led to a problem I'll comically call the homeless private jet problem, which is where do you park your jet? And especially if you want to go to the Super Bowl or watch the eclipse, or this week it's the Masters tournament.
So they've overgrown the number of private jets, and the use of private jets has outgrown the available private jet space, private airports.
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of these small private airports. They don't have any commercial traffic. And they're running out of parking for these private jets. So, and you see this all over. But outside Boston is Hanscom Field, which is New England's second busiest airport after
Logan.
But it's not. There's no commercial aviation there. It's all private jets. It's the largest private jet airport in New England, and there are a couple private developers who are putting forward a proposal to double the amount of hangar space to help all these homeless private jets have a home. And what's interesting though is that the activists who care about climate change are like, wait a second here, we're going to double the number of private jet capacity at Hanscom Field, which is already pretty substantial, about 39,000 flights a year in and out of Hanscom. Private jets zipping over Walden Pond and all over that area. We're gonna increase that while the rest of the state is working to dial back its carbon emissions. And some people analyzed it and found that the increased emissions would be like setting off a carbon bomb. You know, billions of tons of emissions over the next 10 years. And in the same way, we shouldn't be building new fossil fuel infrastructure at this moment. We shouldn't be building new gas, coal plants, you know, oil tanks. You know, we need to rapidly transition. We should not be building new private jet infrastructure. We shouldn't be encouraging this, you know, antisocial behavior. I mean, Warren Buffett has a private jet. He named it the Indefensible. And I think that's a great name because, you know, a private jet is indefensible on a warming planet. So anyway, there's a wonderful struggle, great community organizations, 80 groups in Massachusetts, all fighting this airport expansion. And incidentally, one of the executives, one of the two big investors is a guy named Jeffrey Lyrink, who was also the venture capitalist, private equity
Oh.
advisor on Stuart Hospital. So
Yeah,
again,
and let me just I'll
yeah.
headline this Stewart Hospital issue, which is I will confess, I have only in the last year or so really begun to hone in on the activities of private equity and the impacts of private equity. And let me give my quickest little headline on that, which is that private equity is sort of the absolute extreme of ruthless capitalism. It saddles companies with debt. It looks for industries that are essential, like hospitals, like housing, and it then it invests little of its own money. It saddles the companies it purchases with debt, and the and then runs with absolutely short-term goals, which are the anathema of environmental or community sustainability, and then it turns things around as quickly as I can and goes on to the next. And the worst thing is that they have convinced the courts, for the most part, that they are not responsible or accountable for their actions, that they aren't actually the owners of the many companies they control. They are just advising investors. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to think of private equity as these huge pools of wealth and power. They're often, the wealth of the billionaires. Where do they invest it? How do they deploy that wealth? And in this case, it's to get more wealth. And I think that what I think when we think about private equity, think of a vast wealth extraction pump that kind of moves in. The journalist Gretchen Morgeson has a terrific new book out called The Plunderers that sort of describes the role of private equity. And it is, as you say, they fix on a company, let's call it Toys R Us, right? This is a company that was taken over by private equity. They say, oh, okay, now all these toy stores have real estate. Let's spin off the real estate into one investment vehicle. Let's take the little stores and sort of figure out where can we cut costs. Oh, there's a pension fund. Maybe we'll we'll raid that pension fund. Oh, and by the way, we'll give all of our deal makers these huge fees, and we'll take on more debt for this company. And it is a wealth pump. It's basically it's like a squid attaching itself to a little seashell and just trying to get in there and take everything that's possible out from what's ever in there. So it is a form of wealth extraction.
Oh yes,
And
and although you were talking there about Toys R Us stores, when it does the same thing to a hospital chain, if you think about a hospital chain, one of the main things they have is their real estate. They're big, and what they did with Steward, right, was that they sold off most of their real estate and then became renters of what the property that was absolutely essential. It's not like you can do your hospital work from home. I mean, this is a place where you've got to have a location. And now the, if I'm not mistaken, that among many chains around the country is either facing bankruptcy or nearly bankrupt, or I'm not sure of the exact details as it currently plays out, but it is wealth extraction, and as I said, sometimes in what are the most essential things we need in society. Talk about housing.
yeah, very similar. What you describe with a hospital and an emergency room, private equity, big pools of billionaire wealth, if you will, are moving into the housing sector. They're saying, where is there money to be made? Okay, well, short-term rentals, Airbnb. Sometimes everybody says, well, okay, they're small landlords or somebody has an extra room in their house. In the case of private equity, they're moving in and they're buying up, large buildings, evicting people in terms of their use as long-term rental housing, and because there's money to be made in certain markets and certain communities on short-term rentals. So the private equity is doing their buy-up, slicing and dicing of, they're creating real estate investment trusts for short-term rentals, or they're buying mobile home parks.
Yes.
So here's a situation where, I got my organizing start helping organize mobile home park tenants to form associations so they could buy their parks and own them themselves as resident-owned co-ops. And that's a counter a good hopeful story. But these investors realize, oh, these folks are vulnerable, they're hostages. You have a mobile home, once you're in a park, it's not so mobile. You can't move it without damaging it.
And one of the things
So
that many people probably don't know, and I may not even know all of what I'm about to say, but that in most cases you may own the mobile home, but you rent the land you sit on, right?
that's right. So you own a mobile home, you've got your piece of the rock there, but you're vulnerable because you don't own the land. There's a mobile home park owner. But oftentimes these were stable, I would call them mom and pop owners, they live next door, whatever. But the private equity, the wealth folks see, oh, these folks are vulnerable. They can't easily move. They're kind of like hostages. And so we buy up the mobile home park and we jack up the rents, and there's nowhere you can go because the snob zoning, you can't move your mobile home to other part of town. So again, they've sort of identified the places where, due to, in this case, the vulnerability of the residents. Or I mentioned this scenario where the reality is the home ownership rate is declining. We all know younger people, young families that in another generation might have been homeowners, but they're stuck in rental housing, backed up in rental housing. Oh, so the big private equity folks are like, oh, we'll buy up single family homes and other buildings and we'll rent them back to people who will, instead of building equity in a home, are going to be paying us. And that's a huge lucrative area. And if, MetLife estimated that, by 2030, 40% of the single family rental housing stock will be owned by these, BlackRock and Apollo Capital Management, these huge mega investors. So yeah, I think it's part of the billionaire disruption. And
And by the
billionaires are
way,
like,
oh, go ahead. I was going to say I did a show recently with Margo Suska, who talks about the journalism that private equity has moved into local journalism. And something which is essential to democracy. So housing is essential to everyone. Hospitals and healthcare are essential to everyone. Journalism is essential to democracy and gutted it.
yeah, it's that kind of, the mentality is, how do we slice and dice this, pull out the profitable sections, make them even more profitable, sell them off, or but I think of this as, and this is sort of a humorous way to think about it, but you got to kind of get into your inner billionaire here, Terrence. You got $1 billion. Where are you going to put it? Okay, so you could have some in the market, but you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. You're going to want, so wealthy people are always thinking about, where can I invest money to hold its value or to extract and get more? And that because you have $1 billion, you can put half of it over here in the parking. So that's where you see wealthy people buying up luxury condominiums in these towers all over San Francisco, New York, LA, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal. There are these empty, wealthy luxury towers. Those are just like wealth parking areas. They're like safe deposit boxes in the sky. These are not for people living in, they're just diversifying their investment holdings.
Right, at the time when LA is sort of the poster child, but all over the country we have insufficient housing. And these people have multiple, many of which are just for money holding. And then, as you have pointed out, I believe, a lot of money laundering goes on through that mechanism as well, right?
That's right. I mean, in this case, we have global billionaires.
That's right.
Who are saying, wow, the U.S. is a stable real estate market. You know, I got $1 billion to get out of my investment portfolio and into something else. Well, what could be more diversified than owning property in multiple jurisdictions, multiple states, multiple types of real estate? LA being, again, you know, you've got, you know, thousands of vacant luxury properties, which are, you know, just little safe deposit boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of that money goes over to the speculative side, which is, how can I invest this in a way that's going to extract more? And that's where the private equity arm, the wealth extraction pump part of the equation, also disrupts housing. So, you know, you have good old gentrification. Some people have more money and they bid up the cost, or you have high income, high wealth professionals moving back into center cities,
right,
and that displaces people. But then you have these other impacts on the housing market because of investors wanting to get more money out of the real estate market, or the healthcare system,
or
journalism,
the prison system.
Or the prison system.
Yeah. Again,
you know,
we might not think of prison as essential, but it's a very reliable source of income. All of these things, if you think about it, monthly rents, healthcare, prisoners who have to make phone calls, private prisons that need security and so on. Let's shift you got about 6 minutes left. Talk about charity, which I know is a big area of your work these days as well.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's happened as wealth has concentrated is that the philanthropy sector, which used to be pretty diversified, you had, you know, small givers giving lots of small donations that sustained, you know, the March of Dimes and the United Way and the Red Cross and these and local charities.
And the collection box at church on Sunday.
At the collection box, small. And of course, we are a very generous people. People give, whether they get a tax benefit or not, we help one another out. And so there is, you know, this pulse of healthy charitable activity. And there's this vibrant, independent nonprofit sector, including some radio stations that we love and others, you know, that make life, you know, the spice of life, you know. And so 10% of the economy is this vibrant, independent nonprofit sector, employs 11% of the workforce. But more and more is dependent on the giving of the ultra rich. And unfortunately, the wealth industry, there's kind of a financialization of the charity sector in the same way we've seen the financial hijacking of lots of other things. But one of the dynamics is wealthy people give differently than everyone else. They give to different causes. They give to, you know, high culture and hospitals and education institutions where they can get their names on buildings. And they give a huge amount of money to their own private foundations and donor advised funds. So in 2006, only 4 cents of every dollar given to charity went to a private foundation or a donor advised fund. Now it is 41 cents of every dollar.
And what was that previous year?
2006.
2006. So in 18 years, it's gone from 4% to 40%.
Right. And the pie hasn't gotten bigger. You know, the amount of giving to charitable giving hasn't increased overall, but the ways in which the money's moving is different. And so now we see a tremendous warehousing of charitable dollars in private foundations and donor advised funds. And private foundations, at least there's a law that says, well, you have to give away 5% every year. That 5% has to leave and go to a working charity, a working nonprofit group. But there's a certain amount of shell games even in that, in terms of moving the money out. And donor advised funds have no payout at all. Now, so the Wall Street people have discovered this, and they're promoting donor advised funds as sort of a tax shelter, tax dodge. You are giving the money away, you're not getting it back, but it can sit indefinitely, building up income. It could be income that's invested in your own company. So you can imagine the sort of selfish interests that have unfortunately colonized a piece of the charitable giving space.
Was there originally a sort of common sense rationale for donor advised funds that's turned, that's metastasized, or was it always kind of a bit sketchy in terms of its real contribution to society, only now it's gotten worse?
No, I think it was not everybody wants, you might have a windfall year and you want to put the money into a donor advised fund. Donor advised funds were started by community foundations that have their ear much closer to the ground.
Sure.
But what happened in 1991 is Fidelity, the and Schwab and Vanguard, but Fidelity created the Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund so their clients could transfer the money from their investment account to their gift account, and they started to compete with the community foundations in this and promoting DAFs. And now, in really the last 5, 6 years, the financial industry has gotten really excited about DAFs. And the one, the charity law, the framework we live with from 1969 is, hey, you get a tax reduction if you surrender dominion and control over your money and give it to a qualified charity. Sounds like a value proposition,
It
a good
does.
idea. So, but what happened is that these folks are like, they don't want to give up dominion and control. They want to continue to control this wealth even after they've gotten their tax reduction. And for the super rich, it is a huge, it's like 74 cents of every dollar is the rest of us chipping in lost tax revenue to subsidize the charitable giving of the rich.
Wow.
So yeah,
So
so actually if people are interested, we're organizing what we call the donor
that
revolt.
was my next question, was
Yeah.
the organization that's fighting this one, and I think that's when we'll have to bring it to a close. But tell us about the donor revolt.
Well, so we've organized people who have donor advised funds and foundations to publicly support charity law reform. So at donorrevolt.com, we just launched it a week ago. We now have, 250 donors. And for those who don't have a private foundation or donor advised fund, they can register their concern at stophoarding.org. So that's a petition and an action portal. And we're trying to build a countervailing movement to the charity industry and the charity lobby to push for common sense charity reform to get the money flowing, and to discourage the warehousing of charitable money and make sure it reaches the nonprofits the way it should.
Okay, very, very good. Again, recent books include The Wealth Hoarders, which is Chuck's book about what he called the wealth defense industry, which is all of the folks who are trying to tweak the rules, exploit the rules, change the rules to keep the wealth where it belongs among the wealthy, damn it. And his first novel, which came out in 23, Altar to an Erupting Sun. His websites to learn more, inequality.org. Inequality.org is where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, Inequality This Week, which will give you headlines that are memorable, and I think that's really crucial. You'll get that statistic that's easy to repeat, and then it will also give you links to probably 20 articles that week about inequality in action. And then Chuck Collins Writes is where you can find Chuck's writing. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, McNally.net. You can also sign up to get a weekly announcement in which I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to probably 10 or 15 articles, some specifically about that week's topic, but others just the good news, bad news that I think you need to see. And you can sign up for that by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, T.E. McNally at mac.com. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and so on. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. And thanks to Kiana in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Chuck Collins, and keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.